In the 128th Block Talks, we speak with Vugar Uzi, COO of BitGet, who tells us about the role of education as an adoption catalyst. I'm your host, Mauricio Magaldi, and this is Block Drops, your weekly digest on blockchain for business. These news are not a form of endorsement, sponsorship, or encouragement for consumption, and are meant for educational purposes only. All right, everybody. I'm here with Vugar Uzi, the COO of BitGet, who's going to tell us who he is and what he does with blockchain. Vugar, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Great to have you here, and thanks for the invite. Who am I? I would say I am someone who is looking for the next big thing. And miraculously, I end up in crypto back in 2017 when I exited my venture. I was lucky, one of the very lucky few that sees it comes through in a Web2 when you build something for a long time and then one big corporation comes and offers $2.7 billion to buy you out. And what you do next, you think that either I continue building it, but money also has some shine and beauty. And then I decided to exit, and it was one of the greatest things in my history of the and my career that I decided to go on and start investing. And of course, the hard-earned money, I couldn't just, you know, give it to the old school to bank or somewhere else to keep it and store it for me. And I went on with a VC. I wanted to help the fellow entrepreneurs because I believed I might not have another billion-dollar idea, but other people would. And that's how I first time discovered crypto ventures and decided to invest portion of my portfolio into crypto. And since then, here I am. And almost like 7 years after, I am managing one of the largest crypto exchanges in the world.
Awesome. This is such a great adventure. And the learning is infinite. So in your journey, what is the kind of three or four or five things that you learned in crypto that you think you wouldn't have learned anywhere else?
Honestly, like the reason I like crypto in the beginning of my journey, because I'm Turkish, and in Turkey we say when you count money, some sticks into your hands. And I love the fact that it is a money business. It is a financial instrument. And I like the fact that everyone in the industry is shamelessly chasing money, because everywhere else you go and everyone is like, we are solving the world hunger. I don't know. We're building the next big thing. We are, you know, doing things that are like value based. But while in crypto, people do believe in a value and all this transparency and exceptional features in there, but everyone also shamelessly talks about their tokens, their ecosystem, how much things are growing. And I really love that from the day one, crypto entrepreneurs have how to make money in their agenda, while in all the other industries, people will talk about everything else. And we saw amazing also products like out there that, for example, Figma, they never thought about money for 8 years. They just built, they got a lot of VC money. They wanted to sell to Adobe. It didn't happen. And, you know, now they are trying to monetize it after so many years and so much venture money. While in crypto from the day one, it is about how we're going to make money, how we're going to bring the value. And second important thing, in my opinion, the beauty of crypto is that because of that tokenization element, from the day one, you can onboard people who believe in you. It's kind of a crowdsourcing. And it's not only about building a venture. We saw with the authors who write a book, and in order to publish it, they do NFTs. So many other opportunities out there where you can build and test your idea from the day one. And especially when I was on the VC side, we'll see so many pitches of the very basic ideas, rudimental ideas, MVPs, and people are already investing, buying, in somehow showing an interest. And I think that is the true interest creation. And third biggest point, I love things on-chain because it's super transparent. This kind of transparency you don't get in any startup where even if you want to do the most meticulous, due diligence out there with by a venture fund or by largest audit company, on-chain, 2-3 clicks away, you see how much people believe, how much actual transactions happening. And nothing could be falsified, while on the other side, we all know how this in Web2 ventures, numbers game happen, Q1, Q2 reports, bots, and all the other things. That can't be happen on blockchain. I think these three important key factors makes, I think, the blockchain a true next big thing for me. And that's how I became a believer. I stayed 2.5 cycles and stick around, and I'm still here, hopeful and very confident about future.
Not everything is, you know, pink and shiny in crypto. There's a lot of the permissionless of crypto also allows room for a bunch of weird stuff, right? And what were, say, the weirder things you've seen in crypto, and what you just say to our audience that, like, stay away from things that look like this?
Oh, okay. We'll come to the audience part later, but like almost like a 6-7 month ago, we were in Dubai. We were having dinner with my friend, and I was, as always, in a rush, you know, heading to the airport. And I told to my friends who covered the bill that I'll send my portion. And because he's also in crypto, I decided, you know, ask him for his wallet and transfer some of the money from my wallet, because I didn't have the cash in my local account. And some time passes and my friends calls me like, hey, how are you? And so on. And he's like, oh, like I was checking your wallet and there is XYZ tokens in there. And like, do you really trust this project? Do you think I should also invest? That was like an aha moment for me. Like, because when you do normal transaction, you send money for your friend's birthday or like another bill payment, they can't come back and check your bank account, what you are doing. But in crypto, everything are like too transparent. And I always think like, how much transparent is too transparent for an individual, for a person, for a retail user, right? Someone is coming and now they know how much I earn because they know my salary is coming in and all the other so many things. But when I scale it to like, let's say 3-4 years in future, where we talk about mass adoption and being able to pay for crypto, it means now we will know who is doing where, who paid for a hospital bill, who did some transaction in X restaurant, stayed in a hotel, did they travel? Like, I think these are like too much information for an individual to be out there for safety and security. And I'm not talking about like only like earning money transparency, but it's also about like then our location becomes traceable, our next move becomes trackable. And this thing kind of scares me. And it's not about, oh, you're going to get scammed, you're going to lose more money scam, but it's more of like how far this technology still needs improvement. But also on the other end, like I was like recently talking to my friends from Unilever, and they deploy blockchain to trace their palm oil production, where they make sure that there's no deforestation and all the other negative impacts of the palm oil kind of leaks into their production. And also they explain how technology could help in future apparel industry to make sure that it's child labor free and it's modern slavery free and all the other actions that could definitely help in one end. But also in another end, for an individual, I think it is very dangerous, very, very dangerous to look at that, you know, transparency aspect. That's what scares me. But of course, so many projects I invested and lost money, and I call it like a learning money. And I believe that it's a good lesson to learn.
Yeah, I usually say that it's paying for education, right? First, because, you know, you can go and take a course and pay someone to teach you the ropes and all of that. You're still not really learning because they're not doing that, you know, hands-on. Then if you get that same money that you would spend on a course and do some hands-on work in crypto, that's a much bigger learning and probably the same price. So you get what you kind of invest in your education. And that is obviously different from any other industry. I mean, the permissionlessness, again, is something that allows you to actually go do some of that stuff. And it's pretty wild how much you can learn just by poking around Twitter or Discord and learning about the projects and interacting with them and doing what we say, the Dior, doing your own research. And that's absolutely. But I like the subject of excessive transparency. What is too much transparency? And I think there are technologies coming about from the cryptography side, like zero knowledge proofs, all of the zero knowledge, different zero knowledge technologies that are starting to be applied in the blockchain space to give selective disclosure, if you will, for some of that data. And I agree with you, individual freedom also goes through reasonable privacy. And it is important that we respect that as a society. Now, in terms of the projects that you've been involved, can you outline a few that you were particularly, you know, proud or curious, or you think that they are adding value to the landscape?
There were several projects I was involved, and I think, like, because of my current position, it's not like a comfortable for me to name the names, but I would go with the several large ones out there that I've been like a big fan for all time. And I named actually two of them. One of them is the Cardano Foundation. The other is the Ripple. I was always fascinated how Ripple works with the government and institutions to make it better and easier for them to issue CBDCs and all the other aspects. And why I believe it's important, because I think since like a Facebook Cambridge Analytica scandal, we know that legislatures and governments, they're not as fast and as updated with the technology. And usually all these legislative frameworks, they kind of follow the technology. They don't set the trend. And therefore, I think they definitely need a good institutions within the crypto industry that can advise governments what to do right. And with CBDCs, we know that the, one of the biggest problems that they don't talk to each other, and how like having this industry leader coming and telling them what to do or helping them do it could definitely be a great portion. And I believe Ripple Foundation is doing a great job and can play a greater role in that particular institutional framework. When it comes to Cardano Foundation and all the project itself, my family are huge fans because the impact of the education they were doing in the developing countries, and we definitely invested for so long. And it, in my opinion, today Cardano is kind of dying out. And I always say the saddest part, because I come from the communication background myself, and I believe the importance and power of marketing and communicating and putting the right information in front of the right people. And I always say, like, sometimes I feel the Cardano Foundation is like a done by nerds for nerds. It's a beautiful product that wasn't explained well, and not many people came and built on, and they failed building that real community that it needed for a project to survive in the longer term to grow. While in all the other, like a Big Ten project, we see that like a Solana, how is kind of a reinventing itself, and all the other projects that out there. I think they're like this, like my two biggest learnings. One is importance, because I did my master's on policy making. That's why like a Ripple is one of my favorite cases to look into. And also from entrepreneurial side, I think like a Cardano is a good example how you can build the best product out there if you don't market it well. It's kind of a best product is who shouts louder world, especially like I always say, like, look at the meme coins, right? Out there, they don't even have a product, but they have a strong community and they engage more people.
This is especially true in crypto. I mean, you can have communities built around brands in other industries, but crypto, as you first said, it's so heavily financialized that one thing kind of circles back into the other and creates this kind of multiplier effect. But it also, it works as well up as it does down, because it multiplies as fast, and then it can, you know, obviously exponentiate when it comes down too. So it's kind of very wild volatility. And maybe this is the nature of the infrastructure itself. Blockchains operate around incentive architectures, and they are heavily financial incentives. So this creates this kind of, you know, retrofeeding effect. You mentioned Ripple, and you mentioned your background in policy. One of our thesis in the show is that there won't be mass adoption without something that we call regulatory integration, meaning regulators coming on chain because of transparency, because of common standardized infrastructure, even making their own lives easier on supervision and oversight and all of the data management that we know that they have to do on regular industries. But in crypto, it's made easier by the infrastructure. We haven't seen a lot of that action yet, but the infrastructure is there. They can use for their own benefit as well. In your experience, if you can share, what have been the most interesting interactions that you've had with regulators? Who do you deem a regulator that is progressive? I don't like to say crypto friendly, because that gives the wrong vibe that they're like, oh, they're letting crypto, you know, go rampant. That's not what we mean, is that they are progressive in the sense that they are understanding, they're engaging with the industry, they are knowledgeable about the technology, they're knowledgeable about the use cases, and they want to make sure that that thrives, but also doesn't punish, you know, the average person. So what is your context, if you can share, obviously?
Prior joining to BitGet, I used to serve as a management consultant at one of the top three largest consultancies in the world at Bain & Company. And throughout my journey, I consulted government both in the Middle East and Europe, specifically about Web3 and financial policymaking. And one of the biggest problems I witness all the time is that policymakers, they don't understand, and let alone crypto, let alone blockchain, it is too complicated for them to understand. And more or less, they tend to kind of copy each other. And especially when we move toward East, we see that they're copying West a lot. And as I mentioned earlier, from the Facebook case and onwards, we know that governments in the West are tend to, first of all, because of the democracy, they work in like a 4-year cycles. And every time something super negative happens, they try to introduce a very harsh laws to make sure that they get another vote. It's always like a two extremes. One is like a very unregulated, and suddenly you get the most strictest rules. And I think that's one of the problems that really blocks the innovation. And when there are like a super restrictive laws, it kills innovation from bottom up. And again, the reason for this is lack of knowledge by the educators. And I think who should be the good educator is people who are interested in the industry. Like, it shouldn't, like, crypto industry shouldn't sit and wait until the regulation comes. And we know that regulation started from the exchanges, and I'm sure it will reach all the small projects and startups and everyone else. Therefore, we should be, the same way we publish our white papers, maybe we need to put some resources out there to establish that knowledge base, that tomorrow when a legislator wants to make a legislation, they would see us as thought leaders. They would invite us to that table of the conversations, and no law is made without the actual end user. And when it comes to legislation, I always say, like, the biggest problem in any sort of legal framework is how easy and complicated it is. Because in my opinion, it should always be foolproof. And it has nothing to do about crypto or financial industry. As simple, because law is a very complicated science in itself. And I served at UN for a long time, especially with the indigenous peoples and minorities' rights. And in there, I saw that women are the main sufferers from this because they don't have enough access to the education. And eventually, within that process, all these women rights issues regarding marriage, divorce, generating wealth, access to banking, and all this are heavily affected because laws are too complicated to understand. And I believe a technology law should be as simple as that junior coder out there and front-end designer, and everyone understands how it works. And again, one last remark about complicated law, how far and dangerous it can become, is GDPR and how consent works. Today, we end up clicking on every website that we are giving consent to something without knowing what we are giving a consent for, because it holds half of the web page, especially on the mobile devices, and we just click that intuitive button to get rid of that user experience. As simple as this, because no one ever consulted, you know, any UX designer while making that law, and law didn't change nothing, right? We just end up right and left giving consent to things. We don't know what they're giving consent because no one reads that 60 pages, and we have very short time span. And all these shortcomings brings me to the point that I started with. Legislation should be really user-friendly, and it always should consult end user, that we see very huge gap in this communication, at least I saw in the last 4 or 5 years.
You struck a chord with me on the education side. The reason why we started, you know, I started the podcast is because I wanted to continue to keep learning about this industry. And the way I think I kind of capture, you know, and I really, you know, settle on the understanding is if I can explain to you in 5 minutes any use case, then it means that I've learned it. And that's why I keep doing this thing. But good points on the ease of understanding on the regulation. I think there's one example here in the UK. The ETDA, the Electronic Trade Documents Act, which is a short, very straightforward, very agnostic piece of legislation that allows trade finance and international trade participants to register bearing documents using decentralized technologies. And it's super straightforward. So now anyone who's in trade finance and uses English common law can now actually register, say, an NFT that says, hey, this is your bill of lading. Go get, you know, the cargo out of the terminal by presenting this NFT. And this is magic, because trade finance is usually very paper heavy. And it feels like something in the right direction, especially because of its simplicity. Now, looking into your more recent role at BitGet, exchanges have been criticized. They have been praised. It's a lot of turmoil around exchanges, and you're running one of the most well-recognized exchanges as a COO. How are you seeing the landscape for centralized exchanges? Is this a part of the new industry infrastructure that is here to stay? Is this just a transition into a more decentralized world? What is your perspective in terms of not the next 5 years, but 10 to 20 years in terms of the organization of the industry around that? Because there will be more education, there will be more regulatory clarity, but then there's also accommodation about the multiple layers of the industry and centralized exchanges, as we learn decentralization as a species, might not be there. So what is your take on that kind of wild assumption that maybe everything gets decentralized?
Okay, to begin with, I love the idea of decentralization, and I think that is the core of the industry. But at the same time, when I looked at the world, we see how many democracies fail, and I am afraid that it is the same destiny for the decentralized organizations, because it puts too much pressure on that entire how the organization is run. And I saw several DAOs that I personally was involved in had that problem of voting rights, people having an interest and lobbying. It's like a full running government. And I believe in 20 years, in 15 years, we will develop a better mechanisms where an organization can function and still have a healthy democracy within to run this organization. Because I believe, especially like the way this decentralized organization is run, is kind of we have to go back to the political studies and learn politics on top of finance. Coming back to the centralized exchanges, I believe for next at least 10 years, we are still here and we are still here strong, because we always talk about next billion users, onboarding all the people in the world to the new financial ecosystem. And unfortunately, with complicated technology, we can't do that. In the beginning of the journey, we were like, oh, Web2 is coming to Web3. After two cycles, we realized that no one is going anywhere. Mountain doesn't come to Muhammad. Muhammad has to go to Mountain. Now everyone talks about bridging to Web2, how we can do it better, one click, I don't know, registration, social backups, because there's already an infrastructure, why we don't embrace that? And I think centralized exchanges, and including all our competitors out there who do the hardest work in there, we did a better job to onboard more people than any other crypto institution out there. And therefore, we are there to stay, and we are the biggest, I believe, the cornerstone of the entire industry where the exchange happens. And also, as we talked about legislation, centralized exchanges are more prone to partner with the government, advise with the legislators how to build things together, but also because of the KYC data and access to the B2B industry. Because especially when we talk about mass adoption, we have to think that most of these institutions, I don't know, hotels and restaurants and airlines, they will need another institutional body to work with. Most probably, they won't be, especially in the beginning, they won't be comfortable to go work with a DAO, I don't know, all the other aspects. Therefore, we do need centralized exchanges to become that institutional bodies who govern all the others within the ecosystem. But while I talk about this like a big vision and future, I also monitor the market very closely, and I see how almost all large exchanges, of course, including BitGet, we try to diversify and make sure that we offer enough products to support decentralized organization. And one of the great examples is we recently invested in BitKeep Web3 wallet, and now it is a decentralized wallet. We renamed it to BitGet Wallet, and it's a great gateway to all different DAOs where you can invest to different exchanges or swap and do all the actions that within that decentralized ecosystem. And we do also offer a dApp browser and all the other products that can support Web3. But again, at the core of our business as a centralized exchange, I think we are here to stay, and we shall be here to stay to facilitate all that big institutional transformation, especially if we see that in 10, 15 years, crypto and blockchain transactions should kind of come and replace the SWIFT technology and all the other big swaps happening there.
It's hard to imagine a world where everyone is a degen. So yes, this is a degening is a full-time job for many people, but not everybody will be able to be a full-time degen because there'll still be other professions in the world because the world will continue to exist. So yeah, no, I hear you completely. And I like these extreme scenario examples because it makes you kind of create this kind of line of thinking. What are the conditions that need to exist for that scenario to exist? And I love your answer. It's definitely something that will be commonplace. And maybe we don't even need to talk about it anymore. I keep, you know, joking that the day that I don't speak about blockchain will be the day that I've done my job and I can retire. I don't think I'll leave that, but it's a good joke anyway. But listen, one of the things that because we're early in the industry, right? I mean, we've been here for around 10, 12, 15 years. What are the things that you, when one of your friends that are not in crypto, they call you up, say, "Hey, Vugar, I want to learn. I want to break into this industry." What is the basic toolkit that you tell them to go read, listen to, watch? What is the combination of resources that you share with your friends who are trying to learn about the industry?
Honestly, in the beginning of my journey, it was always about like talking about crypto as an investment tool, how to build, you know, future portfolio, like growth opportunities, giving examples from the stock market. But during the journey, I realized that at least for community and friends and family I have, it doesn't work. What works the best is talking about people, what they do. You are a graphic designer, you are a social media manager, you are a community builder, whatever you do, you are a developer. I always try to talk to them how they can work within the crypto industry, because I think crypto is a beautiful place to work at because we embrace this remote culture. A lot of people do several things at the same time. It's a culture that very much open to the side hustles, building things together. And that is what captures attention of my audience, mainly. But also, as I mentioned in the beginning of the talk, I come from Turkey. And because of economical situation, in the last 2-3 years, almost everyone I know, including my parents, including my aunties and uncles, everyone has some sort of a wallet, whether exchange or whether like a BitGet wallet, kind of a decentralized wallet. They're very much into USDT. They don't care much about all the other things, but USDT solves their problem. The stable coin solves their problems. And in Istanbul, if you ever been, there are so many over-the-counter exchange offices. You could just go and buy. And there was even times that because of the shortage of currency, people couldn't buy it from the stores. Whenever you took your USDT to exchange, you were actually getting a better rate than any bank, and also no commission at all because people needed that currency. And it was a parallel economy running, and it was solving the real life problem. And I think that kind of situations also teach people a very valuable lesson. And you'll be surprised how quick everyone is to adopt. They know their wallet address, they know what gas fees are. Like, it took like a 2-3 tries with my mom and dad, and they're like almost at their 60s, and they're very fluent. And I think especially also, like, we saw the same similar case during the pandemic, how quickly people adopt if they are really forced to it. And I think that being squeezed also helps to bring people into crypto more than any podcast and media. I served at Being Crypto for 2.5 years in 65 markets, content in 16 languages. But I think there are so many extremes that can replace all that effort in a day or two.
Yeah, what's the saying? Necessity is the mother of invention. I guess that's true. There's one anecdotal case when Vitalik Buterin, co-founder of Ethereum, went to Argentina, and the waiters, the maids, the taxi drivers all knew them because they use Ethereum, they use Bitcoin, they use Tron, they use blockchain in all sorts of alternative currencies because the economy is beaten up. So they know who is working in the industry. It's like mind blowing that, you know, someone who isn't a techie is benefited by what the tech industry created. And they acknowledge that by recognizing Vitalik. It's just mind blowing. Now, one thing that I usually ask for the guests is to pinpoint the one thing that we need to fix now to avoid working on this for the next 20 years, then looking in hindsight and coming up to, we missed this one. What is that one thing and why?
I believe the one thing we need to talk about much often and fix is how different layers and different protocols and different products can talk to each other. And I don't mean they should be fluent talking to each other, but all these technologies should have some sort of a main protocol that things sit within, because otherwise it becomes very hard after 20 years to come back and fix the fundamental infrastructure. And I want to think very much bigger. For example, how the government tokens will talk to each other, how this inter, because if tomorrow there are like, let's say, $2 trillion companies, they're built their entire finance in different chains, how they're going to exchange with each other, how that all transition and transaction will happen, no one thinks about, because now things are very confined within the chain they're built. And I will give you a very simple understanding. For example, USDT, right? Almost there are like, I don't know, 10, 12 chains that have USDT, even probably more on it. And it's very hard to chain or to translate one USDT token on one chain to another. You have to go to exchange, sell it to someone or somewhere and do that, which is a very big question. How are we going to solve it? Because today, if you take like a printed US dollar, you can change it to another US dollar with no problem. But I think that's one of the biggest topics. And I think it's a very fundamental topic that industry doesn't talk much about, but it definitely needs to be fixed. Again, after 20 years, imagining like there will be hundreds and millions ventures built on each chain, it will be very hard to facilitate, and it will be very hard for a user to kind of engage. And because I'm thinking like a mass adoption where at least, I don't know, quarter of the world's population will transact every day. Then things will, when you scale things to that large scale, things become very complicated.
Agree. Yeah, interoperability is one of those kind of hard topics to digest, because we ended up creating a lot of fragmentation as we grow this industry organically. And it's fine because innovation happens at different places in different paces. But at some point, we're going to have to come to terms, because you're right. I mean, I opened up my wallet. There's 16 types of different USDC or USDT. I have fragmented liquidity. Now, if I want to buy a big item in another, like in the 17th chain, where I don't have any of that liquidity, I have to do 16 bridges to get the money across. And that is, all of that costs money to move the money. So it's one of those things that decentralization and permissionlessness in the extreme organically might not be the best answer for the user experience, and interoperability is going to play a big part in that space. Now, we're approaching the end of our allotted time. Is there any topic that you wanted to touch on that we didn't? Because we spoke a lot about a lot of things.
There's one topic I really want to talk about, even though I am running an exchange and all these transactions are bread and butter of our business. One thing I believe as a community we need to work on is to move crypto and blockchain away from get fast rich narrative to actually educating people what is this industry is about. And why I'm saying this, because during the past bull run, everyone was really interested. Then bear market came. Even last year, February, I couldn't convince anyone, you know, to buy anything from a friend and family. But recently, I saw more and more people calling and reaching out. They want to jump on the train again. But all these incentives is like, oh, you work at the exchange. Tell me what's the where I can put my money. Because media portrayed, and for a long time it was, oh, someone put $100 to X coin. In 2 days, they become millionaires. No one talks about slippage. No one talks about liquidity and all the other topics out there. And I believe we need to, as an industry, work more on how we position ourselves and what kind of narrative we build. And we shouldn't let all the great work done to undermine that, oh, put $100, become a millionaire's kind of a narrative, because which is not true at all.
I love that you're angling towards that, because the slogan of Block Drops in Portuguese is the first podcast in Portuguese about blockchain for business. It was never about blockchain for getting rich. It was always like, oh, yes, we're building a new infrastructure. What are the cool things people are building with it? What are types of problems we're solving with such a, you know, novel technology? And I like that this is coming from you, from an exchange person, because yes, you're the one to gain with, you know, volume of transactions and volatility and people operating. But the fact that you're seeing this as, what are we building as an industry? What are the other industries that we're helping build is pretty remarkable. And I really like that you brought that up. And I agree with you. I think if we think about blockchain as an infrastructure and we build businesses on top of it, respecting it and treating it as an infrastructure, then the whole getting rich quick narrative goes out the window, because building takes time. Building community takes time. Building businesses take time. And none of that. And we all want to get rich. And we're okay in doing some of the work and creating something of value. But we don't need to rush. And we don't need to rug pull people and make it, you know, worse for everybody else. Because then where is our credentials, right? Where are our credentials to say we built this and this adds real value to the world? And I love that you're bringing that up. Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. How can people keep tabs on you, what you do, you know, if there's any events coming up? Are you active on socials? How they find you, how they follow you, how they get to know the work that you're doing with BitGap?
Definitely. I'm running a podcast similar to yours. And also, I'm active on all social media. If they just search for Uzi or Uzi the Talk, they can find me in anywhere. And I'm very much responsive and transparent in all platforms and trying to educate more and more people out there. And definitely, almost all large crypto events, you'll be seeing my face doing something. And especially because I come from a media background and I also do write a lot about crypto at different platforms, from Being Crypto to Harvard Business Review and all the other places that are out there.
Awesome, man. It was such a pleasure getting to, you know, meet and know you a little bit better, and appreciate you taking the time on a Saturday to record with us. And yeah, man, doors are always open to you, your show, your work, and hope to see you next time. Thank you.
Thank you for an amazing talk. Thank you.
Catch us online. We're on Instagram at BlockDrops Podcast, on Twitter at BlockDrops Pod or Xerox Mauricio. We're on Lens at BlockDrops.Lens. We have a newsletter on LinkedIn. Write to us at BlockDropsPodcast@gmail.com. And you can listen to the BlockDrops Podcast at Spotify, iColab, Fabriboon Tech, and all of the other major streaming platforms.
Yay!
Shout out to Vugar for sharing much of his experience in the space and so many great insights. Don't forget to leave the ratings on your favorite player. This is all for today. Stay rare, stay weird, LFG.